MacCast, Sunday, May 13th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, looking over things this week, it looks like, I often will say, we don't have a lot to talk about. But once again, famous last words. I think I say that all too frequently, and then we end up going a full hour plus on the episode. So maybe I shouldn't say that. I don't know. I'm looking over things and we've got some cool stuff to talk about and some maybe not so cool stuff to talk about. New Unicode bug, something that's cropped up. We're going to talk about that a little bit. A couple other security issues. Apple looking into using drones for some stuff. We'll talk about that. Also, maybe some new streaming services coming to Apple TV. And Apple canceling plans they were making in Ireland for a new facility. And finally, rounding things out, some iPhone SE 2 rumors to discuss and what's the latest going on there. And then we're going to get into a little bit of feedback. I have some comments to make on the MacBook Pro keyboard thing that's been going on. I've also been hearing from some of you on that, so I want to talk about that a little bit. I'm going to share an experience that I had recently with the TV app in my family and something we had to kind of work around, and you may run into this too, so I thought I'd share that with you. A couple of things from our Slack channel. Our Patreon supporters have posted a few questions and comments. We're going to get into those, and then I have a pretty cool little iOS thing of the moment to round out the show. So should be a good one. Hopefully it'll be somewhat quick and concise this week for you. But without further ado, I think we should just dive right in. So the first thing we have to talk about is a new Unicode bug that seems to be impacting iOS 11 and iOS 10 inside the Messages app. Surprise, surprise, we've had a few of these things come along. This one was revealed this week by Everything Apple Pro on YouTube. It's a video, and in the video they said this is actually something that was originally discovered on Android phones, specifically in India, using the WhatsApp app. Is that redundant? Kind of sounds like it is, but I think the app is called WhatsApp, and it still is an app, so I think that qualifies. But the bug seems to be also impacting messages on iOS and might even actually have a bigger impact there. And really, in a lot of ways, this is an exploit or a hack that can be leveraged. There's a website that can trigger this. I'm not going to get into the specifics of exactly how this works for obvious reasons. I don't want you or anybody running around and knowing how to kind of exploit Mac OS or iOS until this actually gets patched. But what it involves is sending a specific set of characters, Unicode characters, one that includes the black dot emoji along with some other stuff, into the Messages app, into iOS, and it causes the text rendering to kind of freak out, right? It basically overloads it by sending a massive amount of kind of invisible Unicode data to the system, and it just overloads the text renderer, and iOS locks up specifically inside the Messages app. And when received, the initial message kind of appears innocuously enough. You don't really notice it, but once you open that message, you get a blank screen and the whole app is completely locked up. And unfortunately, even quitting the application, quitting the Messages application, does not free up your operating system. It is completely locked out of Messages. So you're not really sure what to do. It doesn't even survive after doing a hard reset of the phone. So this one's pretty serious should you get hit by it. Luckily, there is kind of a fix for it, and we'll get into that in just a second. But, you know, a lot of people are kind of pointing out that this is just another in a long line of Unicode bugs that have hit iOS over the past couple of years. And some are trying to make it out to be more than it really is. Yes, it's maybe embarrassing. It's not really too dangerous. But some sites have been trying to imply that, you know, this is another example of Apple's QA failing to do their job and that there's problems with Apple and the operating system, and it's some sort of systemic issue with Apple. And that couldn't be further from the truth. As I mentioned earlier, this is impacting other platforms, not just iOS or Apple. Also, the reality is that bugs exist, and they're out there. They happen in software, some more serious than others. They eventually get found, they get patched, and that's kind of the end of the story, and that's what's going to happen with this one. So let's not add to the fear, uncertainty, and doubt, the FUD, and take this for what it is. And there is some evidence that this same bug could also potentially wreak havoc on macOS, tvOS, and watchOS. But as I mentioned, almost any other OS could be vulnerable. So what do you do if some nefarious person did send you this text message and you've been hit by it? Like I said, there is a workaround for the bug. What you have to do is basically fully close or quit the messages app from your app switcher. So just go into the app switcher, completely quit out of it, and then go to the messages app icon in the springboard and force press on the messages app and choose new message. And that will open up the messages app in a new message window. At that point, you can cancel out of it. That will return you back to the messages list. And then just find that malicious black dot message or any of them if you've received, multiples. And then simply swipe across it, hit delete, or you can hit the edit button and delete any messages containing that black dot string, and then you should be just fine. That should totally unlock it. So really, it's just kind of locking up the resources in the operating system, and you just need to get that cleared out of there, and then you'll be okay. So, yeah, another Unicode text bug out there, but not a huge, huge deal, but definitely in the news this week. And then kind of following on this, just to add to our fears about security and our devices, specifically our iOS devices, a group of students at Berkeley have demonstrated how malicious commands could get sent to Siri, Google Assistant, or Alexa inside hidden recordings of music or inside innocuous sounding speech. Actually, this thing is not new. They did some of this research back in 2016, and they showed how commands could be hidden inside white noise files that could be played, say, on YouTube videos or through speakers, and then your personal assistants, your voice assistants, would pick this stuff up and act on those commands. What's new now is they have figured out a way to hide these or similar commands inside recordings of music or spoken text, and that could be even things like podcasts. So what could happen is if your devices hear this, say your Amazon Echo, the A-lady hears a command and it tells her to add items to your shopping list or maybe to unlock your front door if you have a smart lock on there. So yeah, these could get pretty serious. Now, there's no evidence at this point that these kinds of attacks are in the wild yet, but kind of that key word is yet, right? They suspect that somebody will be able to figure this out and kind of try to exploit this. Now, luckily, Apple's HomePod cannot unlock doors, and that's for security reasons. And also, your iPhones and iPads must be unlocked before Siri will act on a number of commands that access sensitive data or open apps or websites or things like that. So Apple has put some security checks in place with Siri to make sure that really malicious stuff can't happen. Also, you know that Siri now is also trained to your specific voice, so fooling it is much more difficult. I don't know if this particular exploit can get around that. They didn't provide details on that, but I would assume likely not. And still, there is the fact that some users don't passcode lock their phones. And if you don't do that, then some of these commands could get through. Also, there's some commands like sending text messages that may or may not require your phone to be unlocked. So this could be a little bit serious should it get out in the wild. Do we have to worry about it a ton? I don't really think so. There are some bigger concerns that come into play now that voice assistants can be used to make mobile payments, for example, to another user. So you could see potentially someone trying to exploit this to try and have money sent from maybe your account, one of your accounts like Square or Venmo or even Apple Pay to them. But of course, specifically with Apple Pay, I don't know about the other systems. I think these are this way. When you request to send a payment via a text, it does ask for confirmation. So you get a pop-up confirmation on your screen. So that would probably alert most people to the fact that something was going on, and you can't really access this from the lock screen. But if you are super concerned about this sort of thing, specifically with your iOS devices, what I would advise is just not allowing Siri to work at all from the lock screen. So, and of course, setting a passcode lock if you're not already doing that. Everybody should already be doing that by default. But if you're not, make sure you're doing that. And then secondarily, you can disable Siri from working on the lock screen completely by going into the settings on your iOS device, going into Siri in search, and then just simply unchecking the allow Siri when locked option. So that'll help protect you against this sort of thing. But just a few little exploits and things to talk about here on the top of at the top of the show. I know probably not the best way to start a show, but you know, that's the way the news went this week. Apple is among a number of applicants looking to get approval for running drones or flying drones in the United States. They were in a list of 200 other companies like Airbus, Amazon, Intel, and Qualcomm looking to win the rights to conduct drone flights that kind of fall outside of the current regulations put in place by the Federal Aviation Administration. The program that was running is a pilot program that would allow companies to do things like fly drones at night, fly drones over crowds of people, and even fly outside an operator's line of sight. The U.S. Transportation Department this week awarded 10 states, local, and tribal governments with the rights to host these experiments, and those various government agencies selected different companies to partner with in various testing, and Apple is one of those that has won the right to work with North Carolina's Department of Transportation to conduct test flights. Apple is going to be using drones to capture aerial images to help improve the Apple Maps application, which is good news for a lot of people. Apple Maps still kind of gets some flack to this day, although I think it's gotten a lot better. But anything Apple can do to help improve the accuracy and kind of keep up with that is a good thing. Apple has also commented directly that privacy is going to be a top priority. So if you're worried about that, they are saying they're going to blur faces and license plates prior to any publication of those images. Now, what was interesting about that is, to me, is that if you think about currently how Apple Maps works, what we have is the 3D maps with flyover, and those don't really show any kind of level of detail where you'd see a person's face or license plates on a car. But we do know that Apple has been operating these minivans driving around for their maps, and they've been on city streets in a bunch of different areas for a while now. And there's been this belief that Apple is planning on bringing out eventually some sort of Street View style application or addition to Apple Maps. And a lot of us, myself included, are really looking forward to that update coming out. So I would assume that the ability to fly drones around would also help in gathering additional image data that they could use for that kind of program. And the fact that when Apple made this announcement, they specifically talked about blurring out faces and license plates says to me that they're looking to put out images that have much more detail or are much closer up than what we currently get with flyover. So I found that very interesting. Also, something that came up this week, somebody sent me a couple images of the Apple minivan, these Apple Maps cars driving around in their area. I get them from time to time from listeners, and I reminded them, because a lot of people don't really know this, that Apple actually has a website, maps.apple.com/vehicles, where they actually have the schedule of dates in the areas that they're going to be operating their mapping vehicles in. So they're being even transparent about, hey, we're going to be in your area driving around, so you know, be on the lookout. I guess if you don't want to be in the image, you can kind of maybe avoid the vans in that scenario. They don't get real specific other than saying kind of the city and the dates they're going to be operating in, but at least you can get that information from Apple's website. And again, I don't think too many people know about that. So you can check that out, maps.apple.com/vehicles. Bloomberg is claiming this week that Apple is looking into allowing people to sign up for select video subscription services from inside their dedicated TV app on iOS and on the Apple TV. Right now, you know that if you want to access subscription services like HBO, Stars, Showtime, many of the others, you actually have to download and install an individual app. And many of those apps, while they integrate with the TV app that Apple's put out, they're not kind of directly tied together, right? You have to go get the subscription from one, and then you can kind of access your shows through the TV app. And then when you actually go to view those, it launches the third-party app, and then you actually do the viewing in there. So it's nice because you get that integrated experience of browsing in a single app, but it's still a little bit disjointed. So what it's looking like Apple is looking to do is move things more to kind of a model, much more like what Amazon does with their Prime Video app, where you can go in the TV app, you can find a service like HBO, and you can subscribe directly from inside there. The piece also says that in the future, they might have the ability to actually play the video directly from inside the TV app, stream it directly there, rather than being handed off to those individual apps, basically creating a more seamless and integrated experience. The piece does not, unfortunately, discuss how the payments and fee structure would work. Currently, Apple does take a cut of subscription revenue if you make that subscription from inside an in-app purchase. That's all tied in through iTunes, as you probably know. Not clear if this program would eventually change that, if Apple's cut would change. I think currently Apple gets around a 15% cut from most of those services. Again, if you buy through iTunes through in-app purchase, some of the apps still require you to go out and get your subscription from an external website or directly from that third-party service. So that whole model may change a little bit. Apple may even reduce their fees. Who really knows? The piece doesn't specifically talk about that, but that's always been a point of contention for a lot of these services, is that Apple's cut is too big. So we'll probably get some more details on that in the future. We also know that Apple's been working on their own original video content, and we assume there's going to be a video service to go along with that. How that's going to work out, or how that is paid, you know, whether it's built into Apple Music or something else, or sold directly through the Apple TV app, we don't really know at this point. And this piece does not specifically mention Apple's own original content or video service. So this is specifically for third-party services, maybe getting integrated into the Apple TV app. And that is supposed to happen, supposedly, sometime in the next year. Apple's own video service is rumored to be launching probably more likely sometime in 2019. Well, kind of bad news for Ireland. Apple has decided to stop its plans to build a massive $1 billion data center in Athernry, Ireland. Apple had originally applied to build the data center back in 2016, and it was initially approved by the Irish planning councils, but then it was met with resistance and challenges over concerns about the data center's environmental impact and the effect on the electrical grid, and that ended up causing several years of delays. They had been going back and forth. There were a few local residents that basically appealed the planning council's approval and ultimately had their appeal denied, but then they petitioned with the High Court in Ireland for a review of that case. And just a couple weeks ago, the High Court decided that the objectors could ultimately restart the appeal process, which meant more litigation, more court time, and Apple simply decided, hey, we've had enough. In fact, an Apple spokesperson told The Independent, quote, despite our best efforts, delays in the approval process have forced us to make other plans, and we will not be able to move forward with the data center. We don't know what exactly those other plans are, if they're planning another data center somewhere else in Europe, but Apple does operate another major data center in Cork, Ireland. I don't know if they're planning on expanding there. And around the same time that they announced the plans to build this data center in Athernry, they also started a project in Viborg, Denmark. The Denmark Center is now reportedly complete and will actually be used to provide heat. They're going to take heat from the data center, feed that back into a system that will provide heat for some local area homes. So that's pretty cool. And what was interesting to me about this piece is Apple has placed a major focus on the environment in recent years, and specifically environmental initiatives around their data centers, and recently also announced that all Apple's facilities worldwide, including their data centers, do run on 100% renewable energy. So I found it interesting that there was an environmental impact challenge. I guess it deals more with issues around the land that Apple planned to use, probably more likely than how the data center was going to operate in terms of energy efficiency. But they did mention the electrical grid too, and Apple does use a lot of renewable energy for their data centers. So I just found it surprising that the Irish data center was really met with challenges to its environmental sustainability, because I think Apple would have been very sensitive to that. But needless to say, they're not going to be building that data center anymore. And that's unfortunate, I think, for the people in Ireland. On the environmental front, a little bit more, Apple also announced this week a collaboration with aluminum producers Alcoa and Rio Tinto in an effort that they're calling Alesis. The companies are working together to develop a process for carbon-free aluminum smelting. And the hope is that they can achieve kind of larger scale production. I guess both these companies have been working on this for a while now, specifically Alcoa, and they already have some processes in place to produce aluminum in a carbon-free method, although they really want to upscale it and get commercialization of the process by 2024. They have patents around it, and they're hoping to also license those technologies to other aluminum companies. Apple, in a press release, says the new production process, quote, replaces carbon with an advanced conductive material, and instead of carbon dioxide, the process actually releases oxygen, which that sounds like a great thing to me. For Apple's part, it's pledged to invest about $10 million US, $13 million Canadian toward the effort. And I really find it no surprise that Apple has an interest in this, given the amount of aluminum that they use in their products. So this is ultimately, I think, a great project for Apple to be involved in and a great effort for them to be supporting. And it's nice to see them doing so. All right, finally in the news for this week, let's talk a little bit about the latest iPhone SE 2 rumors. We've been going back and forth on these for a while. They've continued this week. They got a little bit deeper when an accessory maker started showing off an iPhone render for a recent screen protector product that they're planning on doing. And the image that was displayed showed an iPhone 5S style chassis, but a screen with no home button, reduced bezels, and a notch, implying that there's an iPhone SE design, SE 2 design, that's going to look a lot more like an iPhone X, just a little bit smaller, because the schematics show a case that was about 4.8 inches by 2.2 inches, which tracks very close to the existing iPhone SE dimensions, which are 4.87 inches by 2.31 inches. So you take away those bezels and you can kind of get down to that slightly smaller width of 2.2 inches. And we now have, because of this rumor, sort of about three different scenarios forming for a potential iPhone SE 2 update now. The first one being just a processor bump with no major design changes. So we heard about that, I think, pretty early on. I want to say this goes back to either Ming-Chi Kuo or Gene Munster. I don't remember which. And it would mean, hey, we just get a processor bump, something that's going to run iOS 12 a little bit better. And other than that, it looks exactly the same as the existing iPhone SE, which is a very popular model of iPhone. The second kind of version of this is that we get that same processor bump, but then a very small redesign, adding glass to the back instead of metal. And the idea there is we'd have an iPhone SE 2 that would support wireless charging, so the Qi wireless charging that we've got on the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10s, and presumably are going to be on the new models that we'll get this year, the updates to the iPhone 10 and the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus. And then this new rumor that there's going to be a major redesign bringing this iPhone X-like style with the Face ID sensors and the edge-to-edge glass and no home button. And as far as when all this stuff is going to happen, there really isn't any set release date. Originally, we had rumors pointing to it being out already, coming out in March. Obviously, that didn't happen. More recently, they're saying May or June in terms of a time frame. So maybe toward the end of this month, early next month, we might see an iPhone SE 2 update. And there have even been recent regulatory filings for new devices in Europe that seem to point to this May-June date. So that seems to be kind of the favorite timeline at this point. But then with this new rumor, if it is a major overhaul, they're saying the iPhone SE hasn't even gone into production yet. So we might not get an update until we also get the update of the other iPhone models in September. So not a lot of concrete information here. A lot of things really up in the air. If I were to put my money on anything, I'm going to go with the small redesign with the glass back to support wireless charging, bump in the processor, and seeing an iPhone SE model released at the end of the month or in early June. Probably more likely early June, early to mid-June at this point is where I'd put my money. I guess that'll almost coincide with Worldwide Developer Conference, which would be a little bit odd for Apple, but I guess it could happen. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, new sponsor here on the MacCast. Hey, if you're looking for a great podcast to give you a daily synopsis of what's happening in the world of tech, you should subscribe to Tech Meme Ride Home. TechMeme.com, you know, is a great site to return to several times a day to find out what you've missed in the world of tech. And Tech Meme Ride Home takes what Tech Meme is good at and distills it into podcast form. So you get the same headlines, context, and conversation around what happened today in the world of tech. And they do it in about a 15 to 20 minute show that's released daily, Monday through Friday, right around 5 p.m. Eastern each afternoon. So that's just in time for your daily commute or to listen to when you're running around doing your evening errands. So you can catch up on the top tech stories, posts, tweets, and conversations that are going on around those stories. And the host, Brian McCullough, he is a great host, easy to listen to, has a great style. And he is also the host of the Internet History Podcast, which he's done for over 4 years and with about 170 episodes under his belt. So I really think you should fire up your favorite podcast app, search for Tech Meme Ride Home, and subscribe today to stay up to date with all the day's latest top tech stories. And a big thank you to Tech Meme Ride Home for supporting the MacCast. I want to comment and have a discussion a little bit about the new MacBook Pros and specifically those butterfly keyboards. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I received a number of emails this week from folks pointing out that there is now a class action lawsuit against Apple over the MacBook Pro keyboard. And I think there's no denying that this keyboard, as Rene Ritchie over at iMore puts it, is probably one of the most divisive bits of technology that Apple has released in recent memory. Like, people either love this thing or absolutely hate this thing. And there's kind of no in-between on this. And at the end of the day, I think it's fair to say that Apple would have probably been better off sticking with the old design, because people didn't hate it. It wasn't something that I think was looking to be improved upon or changed by anyone. And so because of that, by Apple actually changing it, you have a lot of people who just really don't like that. They hate it. And for that specific reason, they're not going to buy a MacBook Pro. They're literally opting out of upgrading their machine because they hate the keyboard so bad. And that's what we mean when we say it's the divisive, right? It's dividing the community of the people who like it or don't. But there is a whole camp of people that absolutely love the new design. I've tried it out. I think I could adapt to it. It doesn't really bother me all that much. I'm a little bit indifferent about it. I think I would totally be fine with it. But you throw on top of that the fact that there are a number of people who have run into issues with the new design. And I think I've even talked about it here on the MacCast. Apple has a support article that even shows you how you have to hold the MacBook at an angle if you have keys that get stuck and you need to blow dust or bits of crumbs or things out from under it. And we've had a lot of reports of people having issues with the keyboard. And I say a lot with the huge caveat being that most people who aren't having issues aren't going to say anything. They're not going to pipe up and say, hey, I have no problems with my keyboard. You're only actually hearing from people who have run into issues. But there are definitely people who have run into issues. It's not something that's made up. We don't know exact numbers. It's hard to gauge what the percentage is. I myself know some people who've been plagued by these issues, and it's incredibly frustrating. You can imagine when a key stops working, say the space bar on your MacBook Pro, that's a problem. And when you take it in and it's going to take several days without your machine, especially if you rely on that for work, it's a hassle. It's not fun. None of us like having our Macs not working properly. And so, you know, the fact that there is a class action lawsuit out there, not surprising. Anytime something breaks, Apple's going to get hit with lawsuits. This happens on any Apple product. And it happens so frequently that I don't even talk about it much here on the MacCast because I just find it boring. Because really what happens in class action lawsuits is the only person who wins is the lawyer. Right? They're the only one they're going to make out well. The customers don't make out well. They're not going to get satisfaction over this. Apple doesn't make out well. They ended up having to pay a bunch of money. And the only person that walks away with a settlement really is the lawyer. So it's just really frustrating. But what I wanted to talk about is that I don't think this is, again, something that is necessarily systemic. I don't think it's necessarily a huge issue. Anytime Apple does a redesign of anything that's pretty major, you're going to run into problems and issues, and you're going to have to do tweaks and improvements, right? They do their best testing these things, but once they get out in the wild in large, large numbers, you have a much larger sample set. And that is really what this comes down to, is how big is that number of people, that pool of people that are actually having issues? I don't have any hard empirical evidence on this, but like I said, I've heard from a few people in my circle, my personal circle of Apple Mac users who have new MacBook Pros that have had issues. But the reality is I started, when this started cropping up on the MacCast as a story, I started asking as many people as I knew that had new MacBook Pros with these new keyboards, are you having problems? And I have to say, the majority of people that I've talked to, again, a sample size of maybe 10 to 12 people, maybe a dozen people tops, I would say one or two have had issues, 10 have not. So that's 20%. That's still too high, in my opinion. But again, not a big enough sample size for me to draw any major conclusion. The other bit of data point that I have is you, the MacCast community, which is much larger, and I have not heard from a large number of MacCast users or listeners who have emailed in to say, oh, I hate the new MacBook Pro keyboard, or more importantly, to say that their MacBook Pro keyboard is broken. I think one or two people there also have commented on having this problem. If you are having this issue, maybe email me and let me know. Have you run into issues with your MacBook Pro keyboard? We'll see if we can get more of a bigger sample size. But again, I don't think this is as big a problem as the media is making it out to be. I certainly don't think it's big enough of an issue to have a class action lawsuit over. I do agree with Renee Ritchie, though, to say that it is a divisive design, and that maybe Apple wants to reconsider or roll back that decision just based on the fact that there's a large part of the community that absolutely hates this keyboard design and isn't going to buy a MacBook Pro because of it. And that, I think, is ultimately a problem for Apple. If you have something in your design that's causing people to not want to buy the product, that's an issue. So that's something they're likely going to have to address, or maybe not. You know, Apple is historically good at saying, nope, this is how we think the path forward should be, and we're sticking with it. So we'll have to see how Apple reacts to that part of this equation, but I certainly don't think that they're going to be doing much other than maybe tweaking the existing butterfly design to work a little bit better if it does have sort of an underlying problem with this dust and crumb thing. And I actually have already heard that they did a little bit of redesign tweaking, and that people who have gotten repairs on their keyboards have not run into additional issues. Not everybody, because I do know of at least one person who's continuing to have problems. So who really knows? The best we can do is kind of keep an open discussion here in the community. So again, let me know your thoughts on this, maccast@gmail.com. I want to bring up a personal story, something that came up for me this week related to iCloud family sharing and some frustration that cropped up in my house this week. Most of the time, I have to tell you, I absolutely love having an iCloud family share plan for things like apps, for iTunes purchases, for the shared iCloud storage now. It is absolutely awesome. If you have multiple family members that are on iCloud and sharing iTunes purchases, I can't recommend it enough. I think it is really, really great. I love the ability for my kids to have their own iCloud accounts separate from mine, their own iTunes accounts, and my ability to actually be able to monitor and control things within those accounts, including stuff like their iTunes purchases, and more specifically, in-app purchases. And I use the feature where I get notified and have to approve those things. I think it's great because it helps me keep on top of, you know, what they want to buy, why they're buying it, and we can have discussions about purchasing decisions around things like in-app purchases. You know, is it really, do you really want to spend your money on gems in a virtual game? You know, are you getting good value for your money? Is it worth it? And I'm not judging one way or another, but just having that conversation about, you know, why do you want this thing? Are you going to get enjoyment value out of it? You know, what are you hoping for? I think that's a great thing to have. And Family Share Plan gives us the opportunity to have that conversation. So I think that's great. We can also now fairly easily access and download each other's purchase content from iTunes. So that includes things like apps, movies, TV shows, music, and books. So it's been very convenient for that as well. You can go into the purchased area, you can switch between various users' accounts. So if my daughter bought something that I want to listen to or I want to read, I can go in and do that. If she needs to get access to some of the movies that I've purchased, she can download those. So that's wonderful as well. But things really fell apart this week when my kids told me, and I wasn't aware of this, that they couldn't access any of our video library, our iTunes purchased movies, for streaming inside the TV app. And I was shocked by this because I thought, well, no, you just go into the TV app, you go into library, you go into the movies drop down, and boom, there are all the movies. Why can't you go in and stream those? Well, they showed me on their devices, and sure enough, I went to that area and it was blank. Nothing in there. The TV app was only able to show the items that they had actually purchased under their accounts, and there was no way to switch back and forth to access stuff that was purchased under another account. And really the only workaround that they had for this is they told me, hey, you know, what we're having to do is go into iTunes, go into the actual purchased area of iTunes to the movies that were purchased there and actually download them onto our device. Once they downloaded them, then they would show up inside the TV app under the videos. But you actually had to physically download it. And for them, their devices sometimes and very often have limited storage space available, so they can't get that many movies, especially high-definition movies, onto their devices as full downloads. And they'd really like the ability to view and stream those movies, something that I can do under my account because I'm the main account. And it really sucks that Apple hasn't provided this in the TV app, because it was there under the old videos app. This was not a problem under that. So something needs to change inside Apple. Apple needs to get on top of this and fix this for family sharing. Of course, I could go into their devices and just change the account to my iTunes account inside the TV app, and that would get them access to this content for streaming. But that really defeats the whole purpose of having a family share plan, right? That's not the point behind this. So I wanted to bring this up, find out if anyone else out in the community has run into this. Has this been a problem for you? Have you figured out a way to deal with this? I will tell you that I kind of found a workaround for this. Luckily, thanks to the new Movies Anywhere application and the Movies Anywhere service that iTunes is now a part of. This is the service that allows you to purchase your movie content from any service that participates with Movies Anywhere. So Amazon or Vudu or iTunes, you can buy your movies wherever you want, link them up through the Movies Anywhere service. MoviesAnywhere.com is the website, but they also have an app. And then all of your movies show up inside every other service and inside the Movies Anywhere app. And luckily, the Movies Anywhere app allows you to stream content. And because it has integration with iTunes, everything that I've purchased inside iTunes also shows up inside the Movies Anywhere app. So I was able to go in, install the app on my kids' devices. I was even able to go inside the application and add sub-accounts for them. So sort of like you can with Netflix, you can have accounts for each family member. And then inside those sub-accounts, I can actually restrict things, because this was another concern of mine. A nice thing about the TV app and parental controls on iOS is I can control the ratings level for any of that content for those movies. So I could do that inside the Movies Anywhere app under their sub-accounts. And then inside the app itself, once I logged into my main account, I switched them over to their individual account. And then once you're in their individual account, you can actually lock that account so that the only way to switch to another account is to actually log out of Movies Anywhere, which then requires you to log back in. And because they don't have my Movies Anywhere login, they can't switch between accounts. So they're kind of locked into their account, and that account can have restrictions on it, which is perfect for me. So it worked great as a workaround, but I just wanted to point out that I really feel like I shouldn't have to resort to a third-party app to give my family access to stream the content and movies that I purchased inside iTunes. So it's my little plea to kind of Apple to please change that. I'm going to be giving them some feedback at apple.com/feedback. I don't know why this hasn't been updated yet, or this feature hasn't come, but apparently it's not there in the TV's app, unless I've totally missed something, which is entirely possible. I did a little research into this, you have to imagine, but if I miss something, let me know. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. So I think I've talked about the fact that we have a Slack channel now for MacCast Patreons. So if you want to become a direct supporter of the MacCast, you can check out maccast.com/Patreon. And if you become a Patreon supporter, one of your benefits is you get access to the MacCast Slack. And in there, we have a couple of different channels to help people out with Mac issues, iOS issues, and I get questions over there. So I thought something that would be fun to do from time to time is on the MacCast cover some of the conversations that we're having over there in the Slack. And one that came up this week was Barbara. She asked about a replacement for the Neat Desk application, which she uses for tracking receipts. But this is an application for, you know, going paperless. If you want to take all your paper documents and scan them in, Neat makes a scanner. I think their software also works with things like the Fujitsu scan snaps. And it's a great little application, but she's ready to move on to something else, and she wanted suggestions and recommendations. And I personally have been using Paperless from Mariner Software with my Fujitsu ScanSnap for years, and I love this application. I think it's absolutely fabulous. It's kind of a iTunes-style application, meaning that you scan in all your receipts and documents. They go into a single library file, and inside that library file, then you can organize things into folders, into categories. You can tag things and keep track of everything. As a matter of fact, I keep my library file for paperless on an encrypted disk image just as an extra layer of security. So I have a lot of sensitive data and documents in there. I want to make sure it's protected. So I use Disk Utility, created an encrypted disk image, and then I stored the paperless file library on that encrypted disk image. And it's worked great for me, Barbara. So I would recommend that you look into paperless. I don't know if other members of the MacCast community have other applications that they're using. NeatDesk was the other application that I knew about. I did use that a while back, but I just found that paperless worked better for me and kind of how my workflows went. If you're only doing tracking of receipts, I know there's a lot of really great iOS applications. Of course, MacCast supporters and sponsors, Smile Software, they make PDF Pen Scan Plus. That allows you to scan them in, but you still need an application to kind of manage things in. So I know there's some great applications there. I don't particularly use one on iOS. I just take that stuff, I put it into Dropbox, typically from PDF Pen Scan Plus, and then drop that into paperless at some point. So I kind of have a flow for doing that. I probably should automate that at some point. I don't know why I haven't done that yet. That just got me thinking about that. But there you go. That's what I use. Another question that came up in the Slack came from Patrick. This related to his MacBook Pro. He had it suddenly apply a software update without his intervention, and he was a little bit worried about that. He's like, I didn't do this, but I got up and my MacBook Pro was suddenly on a different version of the operating system. Maybe something most of you don't want to happen, right? A lot of us like to apply those things on our own because in case there's some sort of conflict or issue, we want to know about it before we run the software update. So he was a little bit concerned about that and wondered why did that happen. And we went back and forth on it a little bit, and I pointed out that there actually is a setting in the App Store settings, I don't know how it got changed for Patrick, but that you can set where it will automatically install macOS updates. So I bring this up because maybe this is something you haven't checked into and you probably want to look at it and make sure that it's set the way that you want it. So if you go into System Preferences on your Mac and then go into the App Store Preferences, you might have to click on the little lock and enter your admin password to be able to make changes, but the setting you're going to want to look for is called Install macOS Updates. And if that is checked, then you've said, hey, App Store, you can go ahead and install macOS updates for me when they become available. There's also a setting to install app updates, and you may want to review that setting as well. The other one you might want to look into, and I don't know if for Patrick if this was just a security update, but there is a separate setting for just data and security updates. It says install system data files and security updates. The data files are typically things like malware data files that will protect your system from malicious software being installed. So typically, I would say you want to leave that one checked on so that you get any critical security updates to the operating system and any of those malware notices and your malware data profiles get actually updated automatically. So I leave that one checked. I have install macOS updates and install app updates unchecked because I want to do those things manually. I want to know when those updates come available and I want to be able to check and make sure they're not going to conflict with anything before I install them. So Patrick did find out that his was checked to automatically install the macOS updates, and he was able to change that setting. So that's the kind of thing we do over in the MacCast Slack. In addition, we have channels for talking about stuff that comes up on the show, things of the moment, and just general conversations and stuff like that. It is a really great community. So again, if you'd like to look into that, if you'd like to join it, just become a supporter of the MacCast on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/MacCast and you'll find all of the details there. All right, last thing that I have for you this week is a thing of the moment, something I discovered recently. I guess this application's been around on macOS for a while. I'm not so sure how long it's been around on iOS, but I recently discovered it on iOS, and it's an application called Yoink. And it's kind of like a document manager on iOS, but really more like a clipboard thing and something that integrates with the document and file system. So I'm a big fan of Documents by Readle. I use that kind of for my document management on iOS. But one of the areas that I always struggled with specifically was kind of directly downloading files from the web. There is a facility for doing that inside Documents by Readle, but it was never kind of really that seamless for me. And so the big benefit of Yoink came about for me when I realized that you could use its share extension from a URL in Safari to directly download a linked file into the file system on iOS, into the file manager on iOS. And it's fairly easy to do natively, right, with an image or maybe an MP3 or a PDF, because you can load that in Safari and then just save it off through the share menu. But when you encounter something like a zip file or a compressed file or some odd video format, those aren't always easy to download directly from inside Safari. And Yoink gives you the ability to do that, because what you can do is tap and hold on a URL in Safari and then choose the share option. And then Yoink has an extension that's add to Yoink. And when you do that, it will ask you, do you want to download this file and put it into Yoink, or do you want to just save the URL? So it gives you a couple different options. You can then just download the file, put it right into Yoink, and then it's available to move off into any other file manager or application, because Yoink is actually a full document provider. So it integrates with the document library, and you can save it into iCloud, you can save it into Documents by Readle, you can save it directly into another application, or you can leave it right inside Yoink to come back and get later. And you can also use Yoink in slide-over mode to move files around on your iPad with drag and drop and move things from the clipboard. You can even group together multiple files in what Yoink calls a stack, and you can store them in stacks or categories, basically like folders. And what's really cool is when you're moving stuff, you can choose if you want to actually copy it or move it, meaning do you want to put a copy into Yoink and then take a copy out and put that in another location, or would you prefer to actually move it kind of just using Yoink as an intermediary? So basically you take the file, you put it temporarily into Yoink, and then you move it to the locate ultimate destination, and it actually deletes automatically inside Yoink. There's a little lock icon, and you can toggle between that inside Yoink to move between the copy mode and the move mode. So I like to use the move mode, especially if I'm moving something from one document location to another. And Yoink, again, with the slide over, makes that really easy to do because it's all done through drag and drop. So I found that particularly useful. And then Yoink also allows you, just from an organization perspective, to be able to filter items. And you can do that within the whole application, or you can do it inside stacks, and you can do it by document type, which includes even specifying specific applications. So if you just want to see all the files that are stored in Yoink that are Affinity Photo files, no problem. You can click on that filter and it will show you all your Affinity Photo items quickly and easily. And plus, Yoink also does spotlight indexing. So if you want, you can have all of your Yoink's managed files show up in Spotlight and easily access them from there as well. It just is a really cool and handy utility application to have on your iOS device, and it just costs $2.99 US, so it's well worth investing the money on, and you can get it in the App Store. Again, that's Yoink, and as always, I will have links to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but just search Yoink on the Mac App Store, or on the App Store, rather, and you will find it. Well, with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iOS, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. Thanks for hanging out with me. As always, you can find show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast at maccast.com. And I love hearing from you. I love getting your feedback, your audio comments. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can send me email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you want to follow me on the line between shows, you can find me on social media. I am on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.